Hello, everybody, and welcome to our INE Office Hours call for the month of April 2018. Excited to be here to chat with you and find out what's up and see how I can support you in your amazing mission of supporting your clients. We have a big mission, you guys, and every day I'm more and more committed to it because I hear the stories, and just when I think stories can't get worse, getting better, they get worse again. So the kinds of care people are getting is just not what they should be getting. And I'm so excited to have you here and be part of this mission with me, because I think we have this huge mission. And it's interesting because some people say, well, look at all these health coaches that are popping up all over the place and, you know, holistic doctors, and they're going to put us out of business. I'm like, what? What are you, crazy? Look at how many billions of people need our help. Look at how many crazy things are happening in the world where people's mental health is at stake. And tell me that mental health doesn't have anything to do with diet, and I will send you a flying out of here, because it's totally, there's so much that has to do with the stuff we teach that I think we can be, oh, we can be so instrumental in preventing some of this unnecessary violence in the world and the wars. And healthy, happy people don't fight. And when they learn to take charge of their chemistry and their environment, their diet, their movement, their lifestyle, I mean, it's just so amazing. So thank you all for being on this mission with me and indulging me sometimes in getting on my high horse and my prophesizing, because I just think what we do is so, it's the most important thing that people can have access to. So we just need to be more vocal and more out there. So the way these calls work is if you've entered a question in advance, I'm going to go ahead and answer those, because a lot of people can't make it, and it's easier for them to listen to the beginning of the call and then get into the next. So we'll do those first, get those done, and then we'll move on to people on the call who have questions. Personally, I prefer talking to you than having you type in questions, because the dialogue, I think, creates a lot. So if you feel open to doing that, even if you don't want to necessarily ask a question, if you just want to share an experience, that helps us all when we see great experiences or not so great experiences, that we can actually step into our power as practitioners. So star 2 raises your hand, and I'm going to go to the Q&A box and see if there's anything there. Wow, nothing in the Q&A in advance. I'll go to the chat and see who's here. We've got Susan and Regina, Brandon and Martha, and I can't wait to see some of you in just like a month. I was just looking at the list of the people coming to the NEPT retreat, and I'm excited to have Brandon there, and I think Martha was on that list, and I know Lynn is on that list, and it's just so exciting for me to actually be in the same room and for us to be like just doing our thing and really helping change the world by the strategies that we come up with. So I'm very excited for all that. So that's what reminded me when I saw Martha and Brandon and Susan. Susan, I don't see you on the list yet. You better be there. You live locally. Okay. I think you're on there. I have to go back and look again. And if you haven't told us that you're going to be there, just go ahead and click the link when you get your newsletter on Sunday. Susan, you did sign up. Okay, good. good. That was a long list. I'm really excited at how many people are going to be there and how great it's going to be. And as you know, because you live in this area, it's going to be perfect time of the year. Martha M. says, I will just say that not all health coaches are the same. The ones I know are do this or do that. And I discovered that everyone is giving advice without knowledge of a person's history. Wow. That's scary, Martha. And that's why you're where you are with us in NEPT, and you're learning that the value of a history. Interestingly enough, I went to a relicensure class over the weekend, and it was on neuroplasticity. And there were probably 2 to 3 speakers a day and very good information and very much into what prompted it, the health coaches. He said something that I was like, oh, no. Oh, yeah. So the thing that kept coming up over and over again is you got to take a good history. And so many times we listen, or maybe not us in this particular program, but people out there will listen to a few things and they're ready to give advice on, oh, just take this herb or eat that food or do this or that without getting that full history. And everything comes from that history. 80%, I was taught anyway, when I was back, you know, 25 years ago, when I was back in school, it was like 80 to 90% of everything you need to know is in that history. And if you ask the right questions and you dig deep, you get the answers to what needs to happen and how to advise people. So just, it was really great to hear that reemphasized over and over again about history. And I know those of you who come from a medical background who are in the HMOs and PPOs or the NHS in England or any of the socialized medicine places, you know that there's not a lot of time in a meeting with a patient or client. And you basically, it's quick, and they jump to conclusions and they're ready to write a prescription because they haven't spent the time. It takes a long time to take a good thorough history, and it takes knowing what to ask, and questionnaires help a lot, but sometimes people are not able to write and they can't do the questionnaires or they can't do them as thoroughly as you'd like. So it's really, thank you for bringing that up, Martha, because it's so, that is so, so true. And that whole module 4, I think it is, in NEPT, it's just, I think we have 12 or 15 videos on how to take a good history and all the different aspects of it. And Martha, you can't come. Oh, you don't live. Oh, too bad. Bummer. Who says, oh, how do you talk in this format? Martha, if you are called in on the phone, you do a star 2 on your telephone keypad. If you clicked web call, there's a little something on there that tells you how to do it. But if you're on just listening mode, like broadcast, yeah, you can only listen and you can have to type your questions in. So you'll either have to go call in on the telephone line or just go back in through and click on web call. And I think there might be some browsers that don't allow web call. I'm not sure, but I think it used to be that it only was certain browsers that you could do it. Yeah. All right. Questions, comments, stories. How can I support you? Who's here? Star 2, raise your hand. If you don't raise your hand, I'm going to start calling on you. All right. Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hi. You hearing me?
I'm hearing you just fine.
Perfect. So I have questions regarding this alkaline keto way of eating, you know, that Dr. Anna Quebec is talking about, you're talking about, you've been playing around with the Keto Mojo meter, mm-hmm. and there's a bunch of y'all online that have been playing with that. Can you talk more about that? And I have two questions specifically. One is, what are the numbers that I'm looking for? Because I just went ahead and purchased the Keto Keto Mojo meter. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
And I'm playing around with it, but I thought before I go and, you know, gobble up a zillion test strips, you know, I can learn from what you guys have been learning.
Yeah.
And what's considered out of keto, which is obviously if you're eating a lot of carbs, what's considered mild and what's considered full blown? And do you have to fast to get there? Can it be done to a degree with the way we're eating in sweet spot?
Absolutely. Those are great questions.
And all of your experiences and what have you learned? So that's a lot.
I've learned a lot, actually. And I have a chart, which I posted a while back in NEPT newsletter. I posted a link to it. And I'll post it into the IRSCC program, which is a chart of my tracking when I was doing it during a fast and then during the first, you know, week or so of eating after the fast. So I'm happy to share that chart. I'll just see if I can find that. I'll probably put it on the glucose page in the IRSBT program. But I sent it in one of our newsletters, and it was probably back, well, it was probably January, late January, maybe early February, but late January, early February when I was playing around with it. Anyway, so the questions are, first of all, the keto alkaline, the idea is that when people typically do a ketogenic diet, they're eating a fair amount of animal products.
Right. Can I interrupt right there?
Yes.
Right, because before I entered all of your programs, like before I got to the SIV a year ago, I had done the traditional keto diet that's online, you know, the all meat, lots mm-hmm. of fat and stuff. And I did it for about, I managed 4 weeks. I felt like crap.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I felt horrid, and I'm looking at my diet going, this can't be right. I've got to be so acidic. I'm eating hardly any vegetables. And I said, I know this isn't what I'm going to be taught by you.
No. No.
Anticipating, you know, coming into your programs. I'm going, this can't be right. This just can't be right. And it didn't sit well with me. So, you know, I did actually play with that and had my own experience. So yeah, I dropped the whole thing.
Did you do pH testing while you were doing it?
I didn't think to do that. It wasn't.
It would have been curious to do. And that's what Anna Kabeka had found, too. She said that she'd see people doing these traditional keto diets, and some of them were doing actually well and losing weight, but she was concerned about the acid alkaline balance, and that a lot of women more so than men were having difficulties with it. Like men seem to be doing a little bit better with it. So ketogenic diet, let's just define terms first of all, right? So ketosis is the state when your body is starting to burn more ketones, make more ketones and burn more ketones as an alternative to glucose for fuel. And there are stages, as you talked about. There's mild, there's moderate, there's full-blown. And depending on how much ketone is in your blood determines how much your body's relying on ketones versus sugar, glucose, for fuel. The problem is with the traditional ketogenic diet is that, and it's not even, I don't want to call it traditional, because traditional implies like old and, you know, tried and true and passed on through the generations. And that's not true of the ketogenic diet. It was first developed for epilepsy back in the 1920s or 30s. But it's supposed to be high in fat, not high in protein. High in fat, not protein. And that's a real distinguishing feature because a lot of people go on a ketogenic diet and they just load up on meat. Now, in addition to get the fat without the protein, these diets promote lard and tallow, which are pure animal fat. A lot of people don't even distinguish between organic versus not organic, conventionally raised animals versus. So you know what I'm saying. You're getting into this high protein, high fat situation, and it may not even be the best quality. It may be loaded with pesticides and antibiotics and all the other things that commercial meat products would have. But even if you're eating it 100% organic, there's still problems because people are focusing on it has to be animal-based and it has to be high protein. And it's not supposed to be high protein. It's supposed to be high fat, moderate protein, low carbohydrate. So high fat, moderate protein, low carbohydrate. And that puts the person in the state of ketosis. But the problem is they're eliminating like really good foods like some of them I've seen say, don't eat lettuce because it's too high in carbs. Like, what? You know? So the green leafy vegetables, they're higher in protein. They're maybe a little bit of starchiness to them. So they get eliminated. So here's the thing. People are different. Now, some people can go into a mild state of ketosis as soon as they go under 100 grams of carbs a day. Some people it takes going under 50 grams of carbs a day. But for some people, they have to get below 5 grams of carb a day to start to generate ketones. Once you get into that range, they're eliminating most of your vegetables, right? And so when they eliminate most of your vegetables, then you're on a very unhealthy diet, a very acid-forming diet. So what Anna came up with and what our sweet spot really is very similar to is the idea of testing your not just your ketones but your pH. And as you're eating it, you're eating a lot of vegetables. And this is, by the way, what Terry Wall, who reversed her MS, came up with as well. She tried paleo and keto diets, but the traditional way of doing it didn't have enough phytonutrients without all the good plant sources. So her diet really focuses on getting 12 to 14 servings of vegetables every day, non-starchy vegetables every day. In addition to, you know, keeping the fats up and the good fats and all that. So all this said, there's ways to do it and there's ways not to do it. I have helped people design like full-blown ketogenic diets that are plant-based 100%, right? You're just using more vegetable fats. You don't want to use vegetable fats like canola oil and whatever, peanut oil and things like that that people tend to use. You want to use oils that are stable. So like coconut, right? Coconut, macadamia nut, things like that. If you're doing the oil based push. And I didn't do a lot of oil with this person either. So ketosis, right? In a sweet spot diet, like for me, I can go into ketosis by 14 to 16 hours worth of fasting, not full blown fasting, just like, you know, finishing my dinner at 8 o'clock and not eating lunch the next day until noon. That will put me in a mild state of ketosis. And so what is a mild state of ketosis? That's considered anything from 0.5 to 1.5. Moderate would be like 1.5 to 3. And then full blown is over 3. And when you're fasting, it actually goes more like 6 or 7. Right? So those are the different states of ketosis. Zero is when you're eating, when you're burning carbs. So zero, actually zero. Zero to 0.5 is still not, you know, there's a little bit of ketone there, but not significant. But once you hit 0.5, that's considered mild nutritional ketosis. 0.5 to 1.5. And I've done that very easily by maintaining very low carb, by having more real good meal spacing, and eating lots of good green leafy vegetables, right? So it's going to vary from person to person, but you take your ketone meter. The first day, you just do your baseline. And with the ketone meter, you're not testing every 15 minutes like you would for glucose. You're more likely testing once or twice a day just to get a baseline. Now, you may run in there and say, I wonder what it's like right after I eat or right after I do some exercise, right? You may want to do that out of curiosity. But seriously, what I did was I measured it morning and night. And I did this during fasting. And it was more of a science project than anything else because I wanted to see how does that relate. My blood sugar got down to about 33 at my low point on my fast. And it stayed in the 30s for several days. Now, most people would freak out. Would you freak out if you tested your blood sugar and it was 33? Most people would, right? I felt great. I felt phenomenal because my ketones were 6.5. My body was converted from burning the sugar to burning the ketones. And it didn't need the sugar, so why bother? Why mobilize sugar? I was fasting. So why mobilize sugar from my muscle stores? That's where usually when you mobilize sugar comes from. After you've depleted glycogen in your liver, it goes to muscle. And it's like, why break down muscle when I don't need it? I could just break down fat and burn that, which I had plenty of. Not plenty of, but I had enough of, right? So that's the difference between them. So if you want to test yourself out, play with it, right? Start with, just get your baseline. Just get your baseline without changing anything. You're on the sweet spot diet, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so let's just see where you are on your typical sweet spot diet. Like, my guess is you're going to be probably in the 0.5 range, right? And if it's not and you want it to be a little bit more so, then you might increase your fat a little bit or increase your meal spacing or do some intermittent fasting.
Are there particular non-starchy veggies that tend to be...
They tend to raise it more than others?
Yeah.
That tend to raise ketones more, that tend to raise glucose more.
I'm not sure what I'm asking.
Okay, so there are certain non-starchy vegetables that might pull you out of ketosis more so than others. Is that what you want to ask? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, so things like red bell pepper, carrot. Well, carrots are considered a starchy vegetable. But red bell pepper has a little bit more sweetness to it. Onion can be there, has a little bit more sweetness to it. Even cauliflower can be, because cauliflower just tends to be a little more starchy, right?
Okay.
So it's those that would. So if you were to look and say, wow, I want to see if what I have to do to raise my level of ketosis, you might look at some of those things and stick with maybe just doing green leafies, you know, lots of green leafies for a few days. Celery is very, very low. It's mostly water, right? Cucumbers very low. So those wouldn't unlikely take you out of ketosis.
Okay, that's helpful. And because I was thinking this could be, because I've got somebody else that I'm talking to about this,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were doing, you know, the more mainstream ketogenic diet. So
who does some ketogenic, like plant-based ketogenic stuff is Elena Love.
Oh, yeah?
She had a program a while back that she talked about it being a plant-based keto plan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. And you got to be careful of protein. That's the thing that people don't realize. And if people who are just like following a ketogenic diet but not actually testing, we don't even know if they're really in ketosis, right? So what they're doing is a lot of them are adding too much protein. And what happens with protein is if you eat more protein than you need for protein needs, the rest of it can get converted to sugar. The branched chain amino acids anyway can get converted to glucose. So you can actually be raising your glucose by eating too much sugar, too much protein. And that's one thing people don't realize. I'm on the sweet spot and doing all this. And well, what did you have? You know, well, I just had like chicken at every meal. Well, it's possible that was too much protein for you. And I had protein powder. And you know what I'm saying? They're like, I didn't have any starchy things, but the too much protein can contribute as well.
Cool. So I guess it could be advantageous then if we're not ready to do like full blown water fasting or something like that to, you know, once a week or once a month, you know, designate a couple days to try and push ourselves into a slightly more ketogenic state. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, and you can do that with intermittent fasting. So there's a couple of ways people define intermittent fasting, right? One is a full 24-hour fast. I like to do this 2 days a week, but not consecutive. So maybe you do it on Tuesday and Friday or Monday and Thursday or something like that. And you do a 24-hour fast, which means you don't ever have any days where you're not eating at all. You may have lunch on Tuesday, and then you don't have any food again till lunch on Wednesday, or breakfast on Tuesday, and then nothing till breakfast on Wednesday, or dinner, right? So you're just eating the one meal and then waiting 24 hours before you eat that same meal again. And that's a real easy way to do it for most people. Some people can't. Another real easy way to do it would be, in sweet spot we say, make sure it's at least 12 hours between dinner and breakfast, right? But you can also go, well, let's try 16 hours. Right. Extend that a little further. And I find with a 12-hour fast, I don't, you know, if I'm not watching it, you know, and I'm just eating cauliflower soup and red bell peppers and all that, I'll be maybe in a 0.2, 0.3 state. But then if I go longer, if I go to like that 16 hours, then I could be in a point whatever. I don't have my keto meter here to check it right now, but I could get up to, I think the other day I was up to like 0.8. It was 0.8. So it's a mild to nutritional ketosis.
Okay. Well, yeah, I've got the eating, the spacing of the meals down, you know, that I've been pretty diligent on because I just feel better when I do that. I usually have dinner at 4 and I don't eat again until 10 or 11 the next day.
Great. Well, that's already 4 and 10 would be 60. That's already like 16, 18 hours. So, yeah.
I could push that.
So test it. You might already be in, you know, pretty good state right now just by doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. And I would be curious to see what it is in the morning, you know, like as you get closer to that, right before you eat your first meal, test yourself.
Oh, okay.
Right. That would be where I would test it first. And then I would test it again within an hour after eating that second meal or within half an hour, 5 minutes after eating that second meal and then see how it goes, you know, just see how the numbers are. Cause I'd be curious to see, does the glucose come up and the ketones go down? But the ketones generally don't go down as quickly as they come up, go up as quickly. Wait a minute. They don't generally come down as quickly as they go up. So, for example, I remember having my first meal after fasting, and I tested, and my blood sugar was probably, I don't know, maybe in the 60s at that point, 50s probably. And then my ketones were like, I don't know, 6.7 or 6.5.
Wow.
And then I had my first meal, and I ended up with, the glucose went up, and it actually went up to, I was shocked that it went up into the 80s or 90s, that it went up a lot, and it wasn't a high glucose meal, but it did have onions in it, and that's what my husband and I suspected, because it happened to him too. We're like, I wonder if the onions could have done it. But the ketones actually stayed pretty high until the next day. And then the ketones, you know, came down. Like, you know, once I ate multiple meals, the ketones started coming down.
Okay, so the ketones don't necessarily move as quickly as the glucose.
That's been my experience. I haven't seen anything actually documented on that, But yeah, that's been my experience. They don't come down as, now I don't experiment by having a super high glucose meal, right? So, right, my cauliflower, red bell pepper or something, but I don't have something like, you know, a chocolate bar with sugar in it or anything. And I don't know if that would just like plummet the ketones and jack up the glucose, but I haven't tested that. I'm not willing to test that.
I hear you on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's super helpful.
Good questions. I love talking about this stuff. It's so fascinating.
I mean,
so let us know. Like, let us know how it works and how your testing goes, because I'd be curious.
Yeah, I'll play around with it for the next month.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So, Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Well, first of all, when you were talking about the taking a good history, I think it's we're actually in the process of having to train our clients, because they're used to going in and within 5 minutes getting quote unquote a prescription. I find that a lot of the clients that I work with, they're always like, "So what do I take? What do I take?" And I'm like, "Hold your roll. Let me get more information." I mean, my intake process is rather lengthy in terms of, I use Living Matrix, which has like 30 pages of intake, plus my first session is about an hour and a half before I even put together a plan. And I find that a lot of people are impatient with that process. And it's about, like I said, retraining them. I even have people later on, you know, I have a process of, you know, well, about after 3 months, we do a retest, and then I do an update on the intake form, and then I will have a sit down with the person. And even at that point, I figured that, okay, they should be used to my process by now. But even at that point, I had one young lady, she's like, "Just tell me what to do with my supplement." I was like, "I don't know what to do with your supplement. In 3 months, you know? But here's my lab work." I said, "Your lab work is just one part of the entire thing. I can't go off and just..."
No, totally, totally. You're totally right on. And I have an interesting story that one of the instructors at this program I went to over the weekend, he said he gets a lot of calls from other practitioners. He also has a supplement line. So he gets a lot of calls from other practitioners, functional medicine practitioners generally, who are stuck, right? They're stuck. And he says, you know, if you're stuck, there's a bit of information you haven't gotten. There's something missing, whether it's something in a lab, whether it's something in the history. And so he'll say, he starts to ask these questions. Well, what are they doing about this? And what about that? And what about this? And he says, he had this one guy. He's like, "Yeah, but just tell me what supplements I should give them." "Well, we haven't gotten there yet. I need to figure out what's wrong." Blah, 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 blah. "Well, tell me what supplements I should get." And over. And he said it just went on and on and on. He, after an hour of talking to this guy, he's still saying, "Okay, so what supplements should I give him?" So it's common. It's not just our clients that have to be retrained. It's actually, you know, practitioners who've been in practice for a while, or even functional medicine practitioners who are in busy practices, right, where they don't take the time. They just go boom, 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 run a bunch of labs and let's give you some supplements based on it. It's a problem. It's a serious problem. So thanks for bringing that up. We do need to retrain everybody that we deal with that it's a process, and there's so much gem. He goes, this guy I was talking to, he said, and he's, by the way, trained as a dentist, and he became a functional medicine doc, a very avid researcher. And he said that the process is, you know, there's so many little things. It might be a simple little exposure that you forgot to ask them about. And he said, basically, when he works with these clients that have been referred from other practitioners, he builds the rapport, but then you know what he said, the important question I ask, and I was just so related to this, he says, "So tell me about your childhood." Because so much of it comes from, like, they're not getting better. And if you don't ask them those adverse childhood events things, those ACEs studies type questions, you're going to miss something, because it's something like that that happened to them, some traumatic event that happened to them in childhood that's impacting their health right now. And if you don't ask the questions, you're not going to know that. You're going to be giving them this supplement and that supplement and spending thousands of dollars on testing with this person, when in reality, you need to heal some emotional trauma.
And a lot of functional medicine fall into the same trap, that all they want to do is just supplements. And so even the supplements at the functional medicine people, they still have that mentality. And I'm just like, no, let's talk about, have you tried your heart focused breathing? You know, let's talk about you doing your exercise, you know, just the simple things. And they're like, but what pill do I take? I'm like, oh God.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm seeing it. I don't know if some of you see this in the Sweet Spot Facebook group, but we see this all the time where they're going, well, I'm taking the chromium and the magnesium and the DHA and I'm eating this way and my sugar's still going up. What other supplements should I take? I'm like, breathe. You got to get your stress level down. And they look at it like, yeah, we teach them all these components, all these pillars of health. But they're going to focus on that one, right? That one, that nutrition pillar, or whether it's an exercise pillar, if they intend to be there. And they're not really looking at, well, I don't do that. That's not that important. It's the food that's really important, right? It's the supplements. No, it's the whole picture. Slow down. Let's breathe. Let's breathe together. Let's focus on your heart. And let's let, you know, your body really heal itself. So, yeah, that's an excellent point, Michelle.
I had a question going back to what we were talking about with ketosis.
Yep.
Why is it that diabetics are told not to go into ketosis?
Okay, say that again. It's a little hard to hear you. Say that again. Why are people told not to?
You know, with diabetics, they check their urine for ketones in their urine to discern whether or not they're going into ketoacidosis.
Right.
So what's the difference between ketones being high in the urine with ketoacidosis and ketosis with a high ketones in the blood?
That's an excellent question, and people get it confused all the time. In ketosis, we're driving towards low glucose and high levels of ketone bodies so that the body is not having to burn sugar and doesn't need the insulin. It lets the insulin receptors heal and it's brain clarity. So that's ketosis. Ketoacidosis is what we talked about at the beginning, is where the person's very acidic. They're in ketosis and they have high levels of glucose. And that's where the diabetics come in. And that comes from a dysregulation of the whole system. And it can be very dangerous for them to get into that when the sugar is still high, but the ketones are going up and they're acidic, and that can be life-threatening. So the difference is, in a ketosis, that the positive ketosis is, we're looking at both. We're looking at glucose and ketone. That's a mistake I think a lot of people make when they do these ketone diets. They're not testing their glucose as well. So we look at low sugar, high ketones. So what happened, and I watched it happen for me, wow, my blood sugar is 33, holy cow. Let me go test my ketones. Oh, my ketones are 6.5. Great. Now, if my ketones were 6.5 and my blood sugar was going over 100, 120, 130, 140, that's a problem. And I was guiding somebody through a fast who was diabetic, who was on the medication. He was on metformin and insulin. And he wanted, and I did it because it's a friend and I wanted to help him. But I said, we have to monitor this so carefully, and you're going to give me these numbers. And so he started to test his, I let him go a week without testing his ketones because he was waiting for the meter to come in, and I didn't think he was going to get in trouble then. But we watched, and when he said, at one point, he did the urine ketones. He hadn't gotten his meter yet. He just did the urine ketones. And he said, it looks like it says it's above 15. I started to get a little concerned. I was like, test your glucose. What's your glucose? He says, it's 67. I'm not concerned, right? Test your pH. Just get out that pH strip. Test your pH. What is it? It's 6.7. Not concerned, right? But if he had said it was five below five on the pH, and he said that his glucose was 150 with that high ketones, I'd be telling him to go right to the doctor and get checked, go to the emergency room, because I'm not taking that chance. Make sense?
So let me see if I understand correctly.
Mm-hmm.
If the blood glucose is high and the ketones are high, then that's a dangerous situation.
Right. And you test the pH as well. And if you get a low pH, then you're going, this is dangerous. You got to get checked out. But the ketones and the glucose, so in a ketosis, a healthy ketosis.
I'm sorry.
they're opposite each other. As the ketones go up, the blood sugar goes down.
And what happens if their glucose is not going down? What's the mechanism behind that? Why is it that the glucose is not going down?
Well, not making enough insulin in type 1 diabetics or a lot of people, or making too much insulin but having severe insulin resistance. So that's where you'd get them into the hospital to get them, you know, get them on a monitored level of insulin to get their sugar down. I mean, this only happens in really severe diabetics. It's not a common occurrence. And it doesn't happen in your run-of-the-mill person who's, you know, got a fasting blood sugar of 110 and they're insulin resistant. This happens in uncontrolled diabetes. All right, you're going to see those same people with their hemoglobin A1C at 10 or 11, right? You're not going to see this in somebody whose hemoglobin A1C is 6. In general, right? But you always want to err on the side of caution. And if the numbers look flaky, you tell them to get to the ER or to their doctor right away because you don't want to be liable for them going into ketoacidosis. Is that clear? Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. Brenda.
One other question.
Go ahead.
Wait, urine or blood?
On ketones?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say blood. You can't really trust the strips because they're ranges and they just give you a ballpark and they're not accurate. Yeah, definitely blood on ketones. And, I mean, you can certainly test urine for glucose, and if you have urine, glucose spilling into the urine, they're in trouble. They're uncontrolled. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Sure. All right, so we have Brenda. Hello, Brenda.
Hello. Happy spring. How are you?
I am very good. I love that it's spring. I love that the weather is gorgeous and sunny and things are blooming and happy day.
Me too. I just wanted to share a success story. My brother-in-law, my sister called me in a panic because he's probably 45 pounds overweight. He's a big guy, 6'4". Hands and feet going numb, tingling, did the blood work, and they said pre-diabetic, but when I told her to get a meter, he was testing fasting glucose at 123 above 120.
Yeah.
So in a week's time of shifting the diet radically, getting all the junk out, and he confessed that he was a sugar holic. Unbeknownst to her, he would have a bag of sugar and literally just eat out of the bag. Terrible. I know. So that was his drug of choice. And so after a week, got him on all the supplements to start him out, just like the program says. He's now testing at 94.
Nice. After a week. That's amazing.
After a week. She's so excited. So she said, it's the supplements. He said, no, it's everything.
No, it's
not the supplements. Not just the supplements. Yeah.
Well, they want to believe that because they want to believe they could just stay on the supplements and go back to the old diet and still be okay.
Exactly. That,
you know, it's just the mind of an addict, let me tell you.
Right, yeah. And so it goes perfectly with what you were talking about. Like, just give me that quick fix. That pill is going to fix me. No, it's everything. It's all the hard work. But
yep.
I was really...
It's great. Congratulations. Good job. Now, will you get Tim to stick with it? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. No, I told her this is good for the entire family because she's got twin boys, and one of them has always been overweight with digestive issues. And, you know, Mom, I have boobs, and everybody makes fun of me. I said, James, you got to really, you know, work with him. So I said, no, this is good for the whole family, not just your hobby. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the kids may fight it for a while, but, you know, if you teach her great ways to make things taste great, how they can still have pizza and lasagna and not, you know, have it be bad for them, and still make chocolate cake or whatever. I mean, because that's the stuff we've got to transition them slowly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for you. Yay. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I love hearing those stories.
Me too. I was very excited. And I always have a million questions, but I need to write them down because
you don't remember
the moment. I'm like, what do I want to ask?
Oh, bummer.
I know. Are you familiar with the supplement, going back to supplements, the Otrantil?
Otrantil, yes. I actually know the formulator. I know the guy who created it. And I know some folks that have tried it. I got samples from him and I had given them out to some people and they've tried it and it really did help with their IBS. I don't remember the mechanism. He explained it to me. I mean, this is, you know, over dinner somewhere. So, you know, we weren't getting too graphic, but, I think it's a valid supplement and it works really well for IBS. Again, it's a supplement.
Right.
Shifting, and it gets them some relief, right? While they're working on the underlying symptoms. I mean, the underlying cause.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I keep working and digging personally, and I started using it, and it really has helped me and shifted me. But again, is that actually healing, or is it just a patch? So
I am trying to remember the mechanism of action of it, and it's just escaping me right now. This is over a conversation I had with him back in January.
Okay. I know it's really high in polyphenols, which is good for the microbiome and healing.
Yes. Yeah, I think it does a little of both. I think that, it's not like you would just take it and not address the allergens and the processed food and the fat imbalances and the stress levels and, you know, looking at the microbiome correctly and eating probiotic foods and, you know, chewing your food and relaxing before meals. And I could go on and on, right? So you got to address
all those things,
too, right? But sometimes when people are just begin addressing that, it's like something almost to get them over the hump, right? Get them over the hump and then get some relief and then be more willing and able. Although with gut stuff, it's not that hard to change the diet because you just don't want to eat stuff that makes you sick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's been me. You know, everything's super, super clean. But it's like, God, how much more can I take out? Just getting to that point of like, I don't know what the heck to eat anymore.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I'll have to look up the mechanism when I get back from my vacation and figure it out. And I'm actually going to see him. Hopefully he'll be there at a meeting. We belong to a mastermind group together and in Austin at the end of the month. And he's in Dallas. So he'll probably be there and I'll just kind of pick his brain again and get that mechanism down. I think there may be some papers on his website. It's Dr. Brown. Mm. And he's in Dallas. So he's a gastroenterologist, an integrative gastroenterologist in Dallas.
Awesome.
He's into food, right? He's into the ketogenic type diet.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, it has sure helped.
Great.
I mean,
good to know.
It's no fun to just be farting all the time. It's just not cool.
So it reduced the gas and the bloating.
Yes.
Great.
And pain and discomfort. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Good to hear. Good to hear. He's pretty passionate. So yeah, thank you. Thanks for sharing that.
All right.
So the supplement he's talking about is Otrantil, A-N, if I could spell it, T-R-A-N-T-I-E-L, something like that. Google's very forgiving. So if you look it up on Google, you can find it.
It's just A-T-R-A-N-T-I-L, Otrantil.
Otrantil, not Otrantil. A-T-R-A-N-T-I-E-L.
N-T-I-E-L.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks, Brenda.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye. All right. Who else has questions, comments? Let me look back to the Q&A. Refresh. Good. We got some numbers and some ketone numbers and all. Yvonne wants to know, is DHEA the same as growth hormone? No. Growth hormone is produced in the pituitary. DHEA is produced in the adrenals. I mean, they have both have growth type effects in helping restore growth, but, growth hormone is actually, you know, it helps kids grow, right? When you have deficiency of growth hormone, kids become dwarfs, like a genetic deficiency where you don't make enough growth hormone. Then we have dwarfism happen. So it has to do with the elongation of growth of long bones and a whole bunch else that we've talked about in terms of managing blood sugar and all that. DHA is produced by the adrenals, and it's the kind of the opposite of cortisol. And so when cortisol goes up, DHA naturally goes down. We call it oftentimes the anti-aging hormone. DHA is an androgen, which is a male, you know, in the category of male sex hormones. If you look at the chart of how the sex hormones are created and all the steroids are created, DHA can then convert downstream to testosterone, which can convert downstream to estrogen. Cortisol, growth hormone is not there at all. So it's not a steroid hormone at all. DHA is a steroid hormone. So those are differences, major differences. Is growth hormone BDNF? No. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor? No. They're totally different. BDNF has to do with the growth and the trophic factor for the brain and the nerves themselves. How much protein am I recommending for breakfast? It depends on the person. It depends on the size and it depends on their lean body mass. In general, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.8 grams per kilo of body weight is, or of lean muscle mass is what's recommended. But for breakfast, I mean, somewhere in the neighborhood of, it depends on the size of the person again. So like 15, 20, 25 grams, depending on their size and how much exercise they do and how much they're needing for growth and repair. You're going to need more when somebody has a lot of gut stuff to repair. When they're in a state of repair, you're going to need more when someone has bone breakage or they have weak bones. They've been diagnosed with osteoporosis. You're going to need more when you're needing to do some detoxification as well. Laura, doesn't sweet spot say to eat within an hour of rising? Is that to regulate blood sugar assuming people are coming off of the SAD diet? Yeah, and I generally do recommend that in the early stages because it's the easiest thing for people to do. And a lot of times it's because, and when people are in a state of adrenal dysfunction, then they need to eat within that hour. That's when the cortisol is highest. And cortisol causes a rise in blood sugar. Unless it's already risen, right? So if the blood sugar is already up, it won't cause a rise in blood sugar. So we want to eat within that period of time so we don't get that rise in cortisol that will then cause our blood sugar to go up. And a lot of times people do have that elevated blood sugar in the morning and they say, well, why does it go up overnight? Well, it doesn't go up overnight. It's just like that first hour or so when you rise that it generally will raise. So you can sometimes tell from the glucose, like if you dip the glucose immediately on waking up, like don't even do anything and then test it again a half hour later and an hour later, you might actually see it go up in spite of the fact that they didn't eat anything. That has to do with the cortisol. So what we do is have them eat within that hour so that we get that. We don't go and break down proteins and amino acids. And we want protein in there because cortisol will break down protein to do gluconeogenesis and raise the blood sugar. So if there's protein in the bloodstream, it will break down the protein that's in the bloodstream. If there's not protein in the bloodstream, it will go to muscle stores. So that's one of the reasons. But I find that, you know, a more advanced technique, some people do really well on intermittent fasting. But they don't introduce that at the beginning. I do introduce that in Module 5 of the Sweet Spot and talk about how they can experiment with this, see how it goes. Now, people tell me, you know, we have the forums and we have question and answers, and they say, you know, I don't really feel hungry in the morning, and I prefer to wait. Is it okay? I say, yes, go ahead and wait. See how you feel. A lot of times, though, when people are in a state of adrenal fatigue, they crash if they don't have breakfast. They crash mid-morning, and we don't want to cause that. And then they get into rapid high heart rate, because when you get into that state, you end up with the rapid heart rate because of adrenal pop. The adrenals are caused to, hey, we have an emergency here, blood sugar's low, blip, blip, go up, right? So we want to circumvent that. Rhonda, ketones. Ketones, I'm assuming, 5, 15, 40, 80 milligrams are the readings on the test strip I'm using at work. Have found on sweet spot diet might have been 40 or 80 at times, 15, or at times 15 or 15. How do these numbers equate with the one stated for yourself? Are you talking urine? Or are you talking blood, Rhonda? That's, you know, if you're, urine and blood are different. I'm looking to see. I don't have my ketones downstairs, so I can't tell what the strips say. It may just be a scale thing, but if it's urine, it's much different than blood. But it might be a different scale. If it's milligrams per deciliter, if it's off by 10, then the 0.5 would be equivalent to 5. The 1.5 would be equivalent to 15 in your scale and 4 and 8. So it may be that it's off by a factor of 10 in the way that it's measured. Like instead of milligrams per deciliter, it's grams per deciliter. Oh, not grams, but whatever the thing in between is, decigrams or I'm not very good at metric system, but it's off by a factor of 10. Or it's air urine. Or are you doing urine? Let me refresh and see. Okay. Let me look at the chat and see if Rhonda's on there to mention it. Urine. Yeah, totally different. I would guess that because it's a different scale, I would guess that if you're, 4 to 8, that's in the higher range. So you're in a higher level of ketosis. And if you're 5, then you're in a low state of ketosis, and 15, you're in a, you know, kind of slightly better than low, right? So that's how it would be. I don't use the urine all that much just because they're not as accurate, but it gives you some sense of it. Yeah. All right. So who else? Okay, let's see. I'm looking to see if any other questions came in here. And let me see if there's any other lines up. No other hands. So I'm going to look through the chat and see if there's anything I want to comment on. Okay, Brandon. All these folks, yes. Yeah. All right. Yeah, so Michelle, going back to the why are diabetics told not to have ketones in the urine, it's because they It really is a lack of knowledge and a lack of wanting to explain to folks. Like, a low level of ketones in the urine is not a problem, but a high level is. And if they're diabetic and they have high glucose and they have high ketones, then you're in the ketoacidosis. Yeah. Let's see. Okay, so Regina, just to reference back, the best way to test ketones is with a ketone meter. The two that I've experimented with, one is Precision Extra and the other is Keto Mojo. Tend to like the Keto Mojo better. These are both dual machines, so they test glucose and ketones, and I find that the Keto Mojo is much more reliable when it comes to testing the glucose. But also the test strips for ketones are more expensive than glucose strips. With the Keto Mojo, they come out to be about 99 cents a piece. With the Precision Extra, they're more like $2.50 a piece. Yeah, and urine ketone strips. Lynn answered somebody's questions. What's the best way to test ketones? It's not urine test strips. It would be blood. Yeah. Adriana, I'm doing well on the 30-day program, the 330-day program, eh? Haha, you're doing it for longer, eh? Any suggestions while traveling, special event weekends? These are really difficult. You just do your best with the food. I went away this weekend. I was gone for 4 days. Now I'm going traveling for 15 days to Europe, or not 15, 12 days to Europe. I think what you have to do is make, first of all, you have to go with the dedication that you're going to stick with it. There's always the availability of salads and vegetables. I'd carry nuts and seeds with you. What I'm doing for this trip to Europe, it's probably more like a 16-hour flight. I think it's 12 hours just to get over to London, and then we got to go down to Italy. So I'm making crackers, so chia crackers with a ton of vegetables blended in it, because it's hard to can't carry vegetables for 14, 16 hours. They get bad. So we're making some crackers. I made a dip actually I had somebody do this for me, Pamela, thank you. I made a dip with red bell pepper and cashew and macadamia nuts, and then making those into little discs in the dehydrator. You can buy dehydrated foods too for when you're traveling. So you have something there. I'm going to bring some of my bars. I'm going to probably bring a box of my bars. So I have one of those every day just in case I need them. But I'm also going to be looking for really good restaurants and looking for people who are, you know, restaurants where they're really, conscientious about food. And, when you go away to a conference where the food's included and they're providing it, I always recommend that you bring some stuff of your own. That if you can, you either rent a car or you take a taxi or an Uber or something to the nearest health food store, get some food, get some fresh foods, ask them for a refrigerator. There's a really great video that was made last summer or the summer before by Sharla Jacobs. Look up Sharla Jacobs. And she did an amazing video of, we were coaching her, Lynn was putting together meal plans and I was health coaching her, and she was dedicated and she was traveling. So she explains exactly how she did it. She brought some stuff with her. She brought cooler packs and brought all these like burgers and various things. We created our menu plan and she brought it with her and she asked for a refrigerator. She actually asked for two refrigerators in her room so that she could put the stuff she brought. And then she took a taxi out to the nearest Whole Foods and bought some fresh produce. And that's what she did. And, you know, this is a high profile lady that runs a, you know, multi-million dollar business. And she did it. And it just depends on how dedicated you are to doing it. Yeah, so just do it. Just do it. All right, so no more there. Let me go check the Q&A. No more there. And then let's look. So hands up. Anybody else want to talk to me? Star 2? Lynn, you have anything you want to add? Anybody? Star 2? Otherwise, we'll call it a day.
Well, I will add a couple things,
yeah,
if it's okay. One is if you, and I know we speak about it, but I highly encourage people to sign up if you haven't already for the retreat, as well as to consider Laura Fine's The Awakening course. It's, you know, when we've been speaking a lot about blood sugar and these other issues with our clients, helping them to connect with why they're doing this, to really empower them with these decisions, much like Brenda was talking about, and even with young people, these tools that we learn both at the retreat, with our retreat, as well as working with Laura Fine, are they're just going to expand your practice.
Mm-hmm.
So,
absolutely, thank you. And to clarify, the retreat she's talking about is for any PT students. So that's not available for CMDS or IRSPT students, but it is an NEPT retreat. And we do it once a year. And we generally have, you know, 20 to 30 people show up for it. And we have an amazing time. We have fun along with, we learn a lot, we share a lot, and we all get time for like really exploring the things that might help us to build a better practice. So it's a great thing to do. Thank you. Oh, and Shine, I forgot about that. You all have bonus tickets to Shine. If you haven't already gotten emails about it, you should have. If you haven't, just let us know and we'll send you the link. Actually, we'll just give you the link. It's shinelivebonus.com. We do ask that you put a $97 deposit down to hold your seat just so we know how many are coming for sure. And then when you show up, you get it back. Yeah, and it's going to be an amazing conference. I just keep thinking of more and more things that we're going to add to it, but it's on outsmarting your genetics. So I'm really going to go into this whole genetics thing and what is it all about and how do you do the testing and what are some of the labs and how do you interpret it? And then how do you actually put this into practice with people? Like how do you use it to design the coaching program, the food program, the exercise program that they actually need? And I'm really excited about it. I've been studying this genetic stuff since it started. I think I first started looking at this in probably 2005, so a long time, and a lot's happened since then, and I can't wait to share it. And just, again, the camaraderie of all of us getting together. So shinelivebonus.com, you all have free bonus ticket to it. And Mona just raised her hand. Oh, and give them the link in the chat to Laura's. At least check it out. It's called theawakeningretreat.com. That has really changed the way a lot of us have been practicing and connecting with folks. Mona. Hi.
Good afternoon. Hey there. Hey, I just have a quick question. With giving my daughter some of the supplements that I give her, the doctor had prescribed some calcium before. So I know that calcium, like magnesium, has different types of calcium.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the calcium carbonate?
I hate it.
Okay, that's what I was afraid of. Well, that's why I haven't been giving it to her.
You have known that. It's Tums, basically. Here's what it does. Calcium carbonate reduces stomach acid. Do you want to reduce your child's stomach acid?
No, not at all.
No.
In fact, that is glad you asked me that question, because the other thing that I was wondering about is that I know with the oxalates, we are giving her the magnesium calcium chews. Now, does that not also do the same thing?
Those are they carbonate, or are they citrate, or are they glycinate, or are they taurate, are they
citrate?
Citrate is an acidic form. Carbonate is an alkaline form.
Okay.
And no, they don't. It doesn't. It actually would help the absorption better.
The calcium is calcium citrate, and then the magnesium is magnesium citrate as well.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Just be careful with magnesium citrate. Too much can be aggravating to the gut, and it could cause diarrhea. But I think that's what you're going for. That's right. Yeah. So do it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what I wanted to make sure of. Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. One of the magnesium sources that several of the doctors at this conference were excited about was magnesium 3 and 8 for people with difficulty with anxiety and with falling asleep and, you know, just in general relaxation. That the 3 and 8 has a lot of good studies behind it, and for brain plasticity as well. So, great. Anybody else? Star 2. I saw Janine just joined us. Hi. Yeah. Okay. Let's see if anything else here. Charlotte Jacobs Thrive Academy. Yeah. She had it on her site. You'd have to find her personal site. I think it is. But just look her up on Facebook. I think I actually posted it on my Facebook. Now, I'm not real good at how to find things on Facebook, but I know that she tagged me in her video. So it's on my page, or whatever you call it, my stream, my I don't know, newsfeed or whatever, but it's like a year and a half old. And I don't know how to find those kinds of things. Lynn might know better than I, or somebody who's a better Facebook person than I. Hi, Janine. I see that. Kim. Okay, yeah. 3 and 8. Yeah, it's THREONATE, Laura. 3 and 8. Yeah, and you get a second free ticket. Most of you get a second free ticket too. So, let's see. Yeah, you can bring a partner. Adriana asked, you can bring a partner. See both. You get 2 free tickets. And after that, I think it's cheaper. I think, I can't remember the price for partners, but they are definitely lower priced. Yeah, you should have gotten it already. So if you haven't gotten it, and you haven't just recently joined, like within the last couple of weeks, you should have gotten one last week. And we sent one out probably about a month before that. Yeah. Okay. I brought the extra training and food for my ticket. Yay. So anyway, I guess just food for my guest who's not interested in the training. Yeah, we can work that out. Yeah, we can definitely work that out. I would reach out to helpdesk@drritamarie.com and let them know that. And we will tell you. I think it's the same as if you sign them up. Well, you're getting the ticket free. So if you pay for the food, just pay for him as a guest. You just pay the $297. That's what the food costs, right? So you don't have to worry about that. You just get the free training. And then if you wanted to take a second person with you, you can share the ticket for them as well. All right. I think that's it. Q&A. Let me just refresh. Nothing there anymore. Last chance for hands raised. Star two. Going once. Going twice. Going three times. We're done. And I'm off. I think this will, you guys, most of you won't talk to me before. I think some of you may have calls with tomorrow. Some NEPT, I'm not even sure what we have. We had a sweet spot call. No, we had that yesterday. I'm looking at my calendar. If you're an ERC, we have an ERC call, but none of you are in ERC. So some of the coaches are. And that's it. I think we're done. And then tomorrow, let me see, we have a practice accelerator and an open coaching. So those of you who are in NEPT, we have a call tomorrow at 2 noon for the practice accelerator diamonds. And a vital call, vital call on in the evening. So those of you who are in vital can do that as well. All right, guys, I am heading out, and I will talk to you all super soon. I'll open up your lines so you can all say goodbye. Bye, everybody. Thanks for a great call.
Bye, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Have a great trip.
Thank you so much. I can't wait.
I bet.
Get to see my kiddo. I haven't seen him in, like, since September, early September.